In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, Warner Brothers Digital Distribution debuted the acclaimed graphic album Batman Black and White as a Warner Premiere motion comic series. Available exclusively on iTunes, Batman Black and White will feature 10 stories created by comic book legends, including Dave Gibbons, Ted McKeever, Paul Levitz, and today's guest, Alex Ross, who with writer Paul Dini created one of the classic Joker stories, Case Study. We'll also be discussing several of Alex's current comic book projects, along with monthly covers for DC Comics' Batman and Superman titles, the Justice Society of America's Kingdom Come story with Jeff Johns and Dale Eaglesham, for Marvel, the Avengers Invaders crossover with co-writer Jim Kruger and artist Steve Sadowski, and Dynamite's Project Superpowers, featuring revamps of Golden Age heroes most not seen since the 1940s. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Vexile from Funimation Entertainment. Ready for some cyberpunk? Vexile, the two-disc special edition, is available now on DVD and Blu-ray. From the creators of Appleseed comes a CG anime movie about the dangers of cutting-edge science of robot biotech. Geek Magazine calls Vexile balls-to-the-wall action. In the battle between man and machine, humanity stands to suffer most. Check out 30 minutes of clips from the movie at Funimation.com/Vexile, V-E-X-I-L-L-E. That's Vexile, the two-disc special edition, available now on DVD and Blu-ray from Funimation Entertainment. Our conversation begins with Alex talking about the genesis of the story Case Study. Now, for people who haven't read the original collection, can you describe the story without spoiling?
Sure. Well, without spoiling it?
It's only 8 pages, I know. But
yeah, I know. It's the grand twist at the end. you know, really, this was something I was so proud to get to create with Paul, because he had this cool idea that was someone he expressed to me that he even intended for the animated show at one point that would kind of debunk the whole Joker is crazy idea. And it would be based around having these guys in Arkham Asylum going through a file by a previous psychologist who had analyzed Joker's history and behavior as somewhat mimicking the pretensions of insanity, but he was too cool and calculating of a mind to actually be an insane person, that in fact everything he had done just typified a very cruel man, but not strictly an insane one. And for me and Paul, or Paul and I was driven to want to kind of rebuff the classic assumptions about him, in particular rebuff the Killing Joke by Alan Moore.
Okay.
Which, as much as I love that work, and as much as that changed the world of comics, I totally disagree with it. I completely think that there's no way in hell that Joker was anything but a real, let me find a proper words without referring to swear words to describe a bad man. He was a very bad man to begin with, and in a way he found a colorful outlet for being the same kind of thug that he was after his accident that gave him the Joker appearance. So in a way he was playing everybody. And I think that that's the only thing that makes a certain amount of logical sense. In fact, I think that's what's ultimately conveyed in the Tim Burton movie.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, Dini gave some insight into this when he did his bit with The Mask of the Phantasm, where you get depiction of the thug, that the Jack Napier guy, who's just generally a hired thug working for the mobsters, who would eventually evolve into the character of Joker, and it's handled in the background somewhat slyly in the material. So this is something I wanted to communicate, something that was a very clear and concise thought that Paul had first, and throw my voice into the chorus.
Well, and your realistic art style, I think, is a perfect match for this kind of story with a realistic take on the Joker. What do you think of Chris Nolan's and what Heath Ledger was able to do with the character?
Well, it's very satisfying, absolutely. He continues with the same sort of thought, that there's a very mean, crazy, but not necessarily insane mind at play here. It's a very conniving mind. So he walks on that edge, too, where it's not about just some guy who's just loopy. And that there's almost like a philosophy to this chaos that he wants to unleash on the world. And I perfectly enjoyed what Heath Ledger and Chris Nolan gave to it. There still is something very magical in the physical impression of what Jack Nicholson's face typified when he became that man in whiteface. There's something that's irreplaceable from having, say, just a giant scar. So there's something to be gained by both versions in both films.
And have you had an opportunity to speak with Jerry Robinson at length, the guy who is credited for creating the Joker under Bob Kane's studio back in the day?
No, I've never met Jerry, but certainly everything that I would want to have contributed to it would really try and get to the heart of what his inspiration was with it. That, you know, we've got the original inspiration coming from the film The Man Who Laughs, where Conrad Veidt had yep. that makeup to look that certain way. And when you see the photographs or the film, you know that's a direct theft.
Oh, yeah.
No, mean-spiritedness to Jerry on that, but I mean, it really, you know, they've already acknowledged it, you know?
Sure.
And it was something where they just took it and colorized it a little bit, you know, just a little bit. And, you know, I've wanted my illustrations to try and convey something that goes back to that original version, where it's not like the Joker that eventually would evolve in Batman's comics in the 1950s and 60s into this scarecrow thin-like character. He never really was designed to be that. He was long and lean. In fact, even in some depictions, taller than Batman, you know, which in many ways, obviously, Heath Ledger was a good pick for that. So he wasn't this cartoonish kind of figure that he would eventually evolve into being. And I'm on that side of saying, like, no, the jaw is only so freakish. It's not inhuman.
Okay.
You know, a lot of it is just how freakish that expression can be conveyed as, but it's within the boundaries of humanity.
Tell me about the motion comic itself. I'm assuming we're around the same age. I'm in my early 40s, and at first, when I heard about this, of course, my thoughts went back to the 60s and the Marvel superhero comics, that the cartoons that took the Kirby and Dick Ayers and all those guys, you know, original drawings and put a little bit of motion. I've been impressed what I've seen with the Watchmen motion comic. What can you tell me about what they did with your stuff?
Well, I mean, I'm surprised it works as well as it does, and it does work. I mean, it's, you know, it's got most of those things licked that would make it seem too odd. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's more ambitious than it need to be. I think they could almost have gotten away with panning across some of the panels without incorporating motion where they do.
Okay.
It's enough to show people the illustrations in a way they've never really quite taken them in before. But they've done all kinds of things with Photoshop to pull out elements that would now be in a slight conveying of mood or motion. It, you know, the only things that catch my eye looking at it is the artist who designed it is seen where artwork has been added in to parts of, like, say, the first psychologist working at Arkham Asylum who's sitting there talking about this case study. He's first not got his hand on his chin, and his hand moves into frame to cover his chin. Well, that illustration originally has the hand completely covering the chin.
Okay.
So it's a weird thing to know, like, hey, wait, somebody went in there and added a chin. You know, a very odd thing to realize subconsciously. I know something in here is not what I created it to be, but, you know, it was all done very well, and I'm a big fan of those kind of what I would call animatic style mm-hmm. of animation. I remember seeing a few of those Marvel ones when I was a kid, because they really weren't in syndication where I grew up, but I saw them maybe once or twice, and I knew the artwork of those old stories from Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, and I thought that was fantastic to take it from the real material. You know, keeping in mind that the animation levels of the 1970s and 60s wasn't really all that impressive already, so how bad was it that they really cut up the comics and actually did that? It wasn't that bad.
No, it was, for us, I mean, seeing it back then and even in the 70s and reruns and stuff, that's all we had, but it really was. At least it was the original material. So it
and it
felt
was a
genuine.
Story that, I think the stories had a bit more depth than maybe the stuff that they would go ahead and sit down and have Hanna-Barbera come up for with, you know, either the Fantastic Four or for the Super Friends show. I mean,
sure.
Those things were so dumbed down
oh,
to
yeah.
the lowest viewer level that kids who were older, kids, you know, 7 or 7 to 13, they were kind of shut out because, like, well, we really need to keep this super soft for these little kiddies.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know what? The little kiddies will come along. Don't worry about them. You know?
I think of the live-action Shazam show, and I remember telling someone that compared to that, the George Reeves Superman was like Pulp Fiction with its violence. You know?
That is very true, yeah. Very, very true, yeah. Like, when if he ever used his fist to do anything, that would be somehow too violent or, you know.
Yeah, Cap just flew a lot in that Shazam show. He didn't really seem to, really use his strength that much or anything.
Yeah.
It was a lot of flying.
It was sadly probably not satisfactory for a majority of people coming to it. But, you know, at the same time, it was popular. It was a way of introducing a character from a bygone age to a new generation. And it made me a Shazam fan for life.
That's cool. And I know you are because I've enjoyed your depictions of Shazam in Kingdom Come and... even just your sketches for the proposed things that you've tried to get DC to do. And I just love the fact that you brought back that Fred McMurray quality to Cap's face in some of even your earlier drawings and stuff. It's great.
You.
Oh, it's very cool, man. And, you know, the Batman Black and White series in general is a great presentation of Batman stuff. They were all really concise, cool, 8-page stories. Little, you know, slivers of Batman's world done by top writers and top artists. I'm a big fan of Jill Thompson's work on this, Dave Gibbons' work on this, and yourself, of course. And I think it's great and a great way to bring non-comic fans, exposing them to your art.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Bruce Timm one. That was kind of a remarkable one of the whole run of them. But, a lot of really good ones were created along the way. In fact, the first time they created that series, I was contacted for a pinup initially, but told, like, well, we can't really have you do a story because, as the editor, Mark Chiarella, put it, you're nearly not there yet.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant, man.
Yeah,
wow.
That's odd. Yeah. Okay, well...
You know, one of my day jobs before getting into radio was in customer service at a bank, and I remember getting a ton of checks from Now Comics, and this might, I know, sorry, but really for the Terminator Burning Earth story, and I'm like, wow, this must be a great comic. I wasn't aware of it, and that was my first exposure to your work, and I was blown away. But yeah, really, I mean, it was just every month there were this more and more checks, and I know they're out of business, so we can't unfortunately track them down because I'm sure they probably owe you some.
That is my first work experience ended the worst of all of the ones I've had because it ended in my having to sue them as they went to chapter 11, I think.
Wow.
For the remains of, you know, they didn't pay me for the last issue or for the trade collections or any kind of royalties. So,
man.
But, you know, I was still lucky at the end of the day. I took more of an ego bruising than an economic bruising on that. Lesson learned, and luckily I didn't have to experience it anything quite that bad since.
Well, and the good news is it led to Marvels and Kingdom Come and your subsequent work. I enjoyed all the Earth-X stories you did for Marvel.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. And really, I think you and Jim Kruger, you guys are a great team. We're seeing it now in Avengers Invaders, which is halfway through. And also, I don't want to miss your project going on at Dynamite, Project Superpowers, which is bringing back so many of these great Golden Age characters and giving them a fresh spin, both an update of their look and certainly fleshing out a backstory that probably was never there back in the Hillman and Nader days.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, I'm not as fully versed on that stuff since I don't own those original comics, and I've done the best I could with research that is available out there and whatever kind of things have been put online or reprints and whatnot, and reading up whatever biographical information so that we at least know a little bit of what we're doing. But a lot of what we have gone into is a sense of they've been transported through time, through these magical means, and so in their reemergence of the world, we're kind of beginning a little bit fresh, assuming that what happened in the past did happen, but now as we may prove to characterize them going forward, we can be a little bit free to invent and reinvent as we see fit. So it's, it's been a remarkably rewarding series because it was no grand plan on some kind of level that would have been we're setting out this amazing scheme about this series that we've got to do that's going to, you know, change comics forever and, you know, reinvent the wheel, which is a lot of the way that I've approached projects like Earth X and its sequels and the Justice series. This has kind of been a bizarre project of just sort of finding our feet as we go along and building as we go along and having a good time doing it. So, this is seem like the ones you're already familiar with, and maybe you are familiar with some of them, but bringing them back and using them now in a way that they fill in for those roles that are often controlled by this or that famous character by the companies we know.
Well, and I'm one in particular that you brought back, the death-defying devil, as you call it, Lev Gleason's original Daredevil from the 40s. I always thought his costume and look was always cooler than the little wise guy stories that he was kind of stuck with. Yeah, so, you know, here's an opportunity for you and Joe Casey to, like, you know, really come up with some really cool stuff, and I'm really looking forward to the further adventures of the devil.
Yeah, the actual sequel to this series we just completed, which there's a hardcover collection that will be in stores, I think, this week, in fact.
Great.
Starting tomorrow, for the first series. With the following sequel series, which we kind of nickname S2, will be really getting into what the heck is this devil character? Is he the Golden Age Daredevil, or is he something else? And questioning just what is his physicality, since he doesn't speak, mm-hmm. and there doesn't seem to be an alter ego of any sorts that is emerging, and it's a lot of the questions that are going to be raised in the Devil miniseries will be finally answered in the new series, as well as the reemergence and reincorporation of the Claw, his grand villain from
Fantastic.
The 1940s. So I'm hoping to impress people with some of the weird ideas I've come up with there.
That's excellent, man. So the first collection, Project Superpowers, then, is the hardback that's coming out?
Yep.
Very cool. And that's from Dynamite?
Right now. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. And yes, I'm glad you mentioned Justice, because I enjoyed your oversized books that you'd come out with around 10 years ago, was it?
Well, yeah, it started in 98 because that was the first anniversary book for Superman, and then every year thereafter for at least 5 years. So, and, you know, a lot of that was kind of like, you know, this ambition I had of wanting to do a synthesis of children's storybooks with the comic arts, with obviously my painted style, but also something that could be read by anybody on Earth easily.
Mm-hmm.
And that ambition didn't necessarily need to be done as many times as I applied it, but I was very well supported by a good editor who always made me feel like we were doing something important and trying to create this legacy for all time. But at the end of all of that, there was this itch of saying, you know what, you've ignored this whole other part of comics and their essential components, which is, if there's going to be one kind of force, there's going to be an equal opposite level of force to combat it. So you really do have to kind of account for villains and the drama that entails, the key conflict of having to deal with something that would stop you from, well, effectively trying to fix the world with your superpowers. And so that, therefore, came the evolution of Justice.
And it seems that theme continues now as you revisit Kingdom Come in Justice Society of America with Jeff Johns. In particular, I enjoyed the Superman versus Superman issue that came out a couple weeks ago.
Oh, thank you.
And, well, you know, that Kingdom Come Superman character, and I've spoken to Jeff about this as well, it's as close as we're going to get to the Golden Age Superman still being around. And it is that feeling, and certainly in your art, in the sculptures that have been created in your style, it you can feel the weight of the world on this character's shoulders.
Oh, well, that's good, and that's what certainly drives my engines when I'm illustrating the character. I really have a great passion and connection with the character of Superman, so why I've always worked on so many different Superman-related images and projects over the years, I always feel that connection as I'm trying to make it with the Joe Shuster art type, that
sure.
What he contributed back then was something that kind of got softened over time and lost a little bit, and that there was this thing where, if you contrast like Batman from the 1940s to Superman from the 1940s, Batman was the one who ran around smiling all the time. Not Superman. Superman looked a lot more stern. Superman had the squinted eyes like Clint Eastwood, and he often didn't look thrilled. You know, like, he had the determination of doing what he was about to do, which is, you know, beat down somebody else or, you know, save somebody, you know, whatever heroic thing he could accomplish. And there wasn't just this lighthearted joy, this big open-eyed or blue-eyed kind of doe-like view of the world that often people like creators like Frank Miller have viewed Superman as somewhat of a blind disciple of the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see him as anything but. And I've done everything I can with the work I've done to put out a different portrayal.
Well, I loved you wrote that Superman versus Superman issue, did
yep.
you not? You see in there, it was his conversations with Lois, and again, I mean, just this is a troubled guy, and I know that was kind of the point of him coming from the Kingdom Come world, and especially that point of the Kingdom Come story to then slip into the Justice Society's world now, and this isn't a guy who appreciates the status quo. He really is haunted by his attempts to make a better world, but obviously things didn't work out, and that he has to sit with the responsibility and knowledge that he feels partially to blame for it. It's always cool to see this kind of troubled Superman, and again, the older Superman, because he is the first hero. It's one of the things that I'm kind of disappointed that the Golden Age Superman isn't around anymore in the DC universe, because I think being that first hero, as opposed to the way they've retconned things, is an important factor to who Superman is.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. In fact, there was an opportunity in a storyline back in the early 90s when they had Superman kind of traveling through time. I forget what the storyline was called, but it was one that Mike Carlin edited that had him going right back in the middle of the 40s, and I thought, well, wait a minute, why don't you have him transported all the way back to 38, where maybe just for a moment our contemporary Superman was seen by somebody else, and that planted the seed for what would lead to, the 40s heroes who decide to then dress up like, costume mystery men.
You bet.
At least somehow connect that he's the very first superhero in this world's history. They had a way of doing it. I expressed this idea to so many different people who just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, who cares? So there's those of us who think that's a very unique position that he should hold, that he is the patriarch of superheroes. And then there's, frankly, a great controlling majority of those that are in power of running the character that say, we've got to keep this guy young and sexy for a modern generation, and if we do anything that seems to date him to being your father's superhero, then it's going to injure the character. And of course, my version, by him making him a 50-some-year-old man or 60-year-old man, is obviously in direct conflict and in spite of that point of view. So I'm lucky I've been able to put forth almost like a dissertation on, no, I think it could work this way. And, the fans don't really, in this case, get a chance to decide. They can support what they support, but at the end of the day, it really takes whoever's in control at the given time to make any kind of grand sea shifts in the way that business is being done at home.
It's interesting because you and Darwin Cook, I think both of you recently have come up with these exceptional stories that are outside of DC continuity, and yet they continue to sell very well in trade and in hardback. And, in Darwin's case, it was The New Frontier. And certainly Your Kingdom Come now, it's over 10 years old. Man, is it 15 years now?
Not quite yet.
Okay.
No. It was 96 when it came out. So.
Okay. Well, and again, it was, I think, seeing, I had loved Marvels, and I did pick up Marvels, but being a DC guy, Kingdom Come really caught my eye even more. And again, I remembered your stuff from The Terminator Burning Earth, so I was really, yours was one of the first books that really brought me back to buying comic books regularly again, because I kind of, as the themes of Kingdom Come even showed, it was that emergence of the new 90s heroes that kind of turned me off of what I was seeing on the
right.
on the stands. And it really was books like Kingdom Come that kind of brought me back, and it was fun to see that I wasn't alone in my feelings and that, you were playing that along in the story as well.
And the funny thing about it is that I was starting work on that. My first work of pen to paper and any of the sketches I did was in 93 when I was still working on the last issues of Marvels.
Okay.
But I had really hoped that I would have hit the ground running immediately starting the series in the summer of 94 when I first was working out the contract and deal with DC. It did take a certain amount of time to find an editor and somebody to take me under their wing there. But basically, I had hoped to get it out before the end of 95 because I felt that it needed to come out as a sort of prediction of where things were going to go with the modern age of comics. But by the time it hit the street in 96, the bottom really had fallen out, and the new superhero motifs and all the raging anti-heroes that filled the comic book universes and had been outselling already kind of taken a giant dip. So when the book came out, it became more a chronicling of what had just already gone on.
Sure.
And it made me feel like, ah, I was ahead of the game. I could have had this out before. You know, I worked so fast on this to try and get it out. But, you know, again, work like the kind I do, it's very slow, laborious. And, you know, just to get any project pulled together with a publisher can take years in some case of negotiating all the terms and when it gets lined up. Because unless you're filling a certain hole that they have an opening for, and, you know, we need somebody to get us this kind of product to fill for, there's always going to be a Superman issue. So in case they got to fill in for that, they need to get done, there's work immediately ready for you. And before you even start, it's already past due. But when it comes to these pie-in-the-sky kind of artsy projects, like the kind I've been a part of, you know, they can be very, very long in the making. And in a way, there's no grand concern for how long it takes because, well, you know, you're not going to affect continuity.
Sure.
Continuity is king. Well, you know, now more so than ever before.
Well, and satisfy a question that I think sometimes fans have with artists such as yourself. I know that you get good artists to work on the interiors of a lot of your stuff. Guys like Doug Clabo, I know, have been helping you with Project Superpowers, and I'm blanking right now on the guy that's doing Avengers Invaders, so help me out.
Steve Sadowski.
Of course. And Steve's doing a great job, and I'm happy to see Namor with brown hair like he had in the 1940s.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask, because people always, sometimes fans are like, well, if Alex Ross is only given, you know, 8 pages a month, couldn't he do a monthly? I mean, how tough is it? You know, exactly. Okay, I'm glad I heard the psst. So, you know, tell people, I mean, really, how long did that Superman versus Superman issue take for you?
Oh, too damn long.
Okay.
But the problem is because I am fortunate enough to have enough different gigs going on of doing covers and design.
Sure.
And obviously contribution to these storylines where I'm checking the script and, you know, even giving my notes and writing in some cases for various things. I've had like up to 3 different monthly scripts I've been contributing to from the different projects I'm a part of. You know, you've named most of them here. So,
okay.
All that time, all those cover gigs, of which I have maybe 6 or 7 a month,
okay,
you know, that can fill the normal work week, no problem. You know, if it takes me 2 to 3 days to do a single painted cover, well, guess what? 6 will fill up your month real quick.
Sure.
You know, so then that meant that when I was working on this Superman special, I started at the beginning of the summer, and I went all the way up to the beginning of October to get it all done because
wow.
I was doing pen and ink for the first time, which does go quicker, but here I've got to really fit this thing in only on my weekends. It was my weekend job aside from the other job, which the biggest problem is, why wouldn't I just drop everything to do interiors for a book? Well, guess what? I did that recently, and it was called Justice. And if you didn't read that, well, I can't help you. You know? You want me to do a regular job? Go buy that again.
Absolutely.
You know? The thing is that I killed myself on that. I did 14 pages painted a month.
Wow.
When, of course, you know, the pencils were provided for me. And then I did a lot of additional work on top of that to make it look like my kind of, you know, my models and my style.
Sure.
But that was a gut-busting amount of work that had me working every single day of the week, 10 hours a day, and people shouldn't live like that. I shouldn't live like that. And I've been living like that for the better part of the last 18 years in this business. You know, nobody's going to take care of me unless I start taking care of myself. So I would love to do more interiors. Economically, I did like 5 painted pages for the ending of this Kingdom Come storyline, concluding in issue 22, which should be out in of JSA, which should be out in the next few weeks.
Okay.
The amount of money I got paid for that is less than what I get paid for a cover at Marvel.
I hear you.
And it took me 2 weeks of work with those 4 or 5 pages compared to 7 pages, actually, come to think of it. It was 7 pages, all of it getting me less money than I would get for a single cover that I would get done within 2 to 3 days.
I understand, man. And I really do. I appreciate that kind of clarification because, and maybe you can understand this too, because your projects where you're in charge and you get guys to do the interiors, but you're providing the cover. I think back to those Golden Key wonderful painted covers back in the 60s. And sometimes when you'd open the book, there was a letdown because the style would change and certainly the quality. The good news is you are getting good people to do interiors now. And I mean, you know, again, if we can't get you for every page and stuff, at least we got a guy, you know, in the same mind frame. It looks like the project is up, and certainly more than, like I said, that Gold Key example. I mean, those Dr. Solars were just, you know, you'd see that cover, and even now you see your covers and they're incredibly eye-catching. The hope is once they open the book that, you know, the satisfaction will still be there. And I think in the cases of like what we've been seeing in Project Superpowers and also the Avengers Invaders, and certainly in Kingdom Come, I mean, you've got a wonderful collaborator there. And right now I'm blanking again because...
Oh, you mean JSA with Dale Eaglesham?
Yes, Dale Eaglesham is a wonderful superhero kind of iconic artist as well, and certainly has a different style than you. But again, it seems that mind frame is there where you guys at least are spiritually on the right page.
Yeah, I'm trying to, in most cases, as many cases as possible, keep the people I'm in many parts contributing, getting them the jobs, working on these things. I might be picking a guy or recommending a guy here or there, but making sure that we're similar enough in overall graphic approach. Like Steve Sadowski works from model reference just like I do, so his take on drawing the Invaders or the Avengers is extremely similar to what you're going to get from anything I draw. The very contours are the same. It's just that the finish from his pages are not going to be painted by hand, but the digital paint box now is such that with some of the projects I've been working on, they're doing things I can't accomplish by hand. You know, they're doing tons of stuff that just kills me when I look at it and I think, oh, you know, what am I even doing this for anymore? You know, some of the stuff I did on Justice compared to, like, some of the illustrations, the color work I've seen on just Project Superpowers alone has made me think, like, God, why do I even try? You know, they can do so much of this stuff so well now with that digital paint box. It's amazing. It's not going to cause me to turn around and start doing that myself because I still enjoy too much what it is I get a chance to do by the tactile connection with a real physical life painting. I like to go in there and paint everything by hand. I like the fact that, frankly, I don't sit at a monitor.
And sure.
No offense to anybody else, which I know is I'm basically insulting, if I did insult, the entire rest of the world who generally everybody is at a monitor at this point with their job of whatever type the job might be.
Oh, yeah.
And I get to actually look at paper under light all day, you know, as opposed to looking at a light source all day. Unless you count my TV, which is in the background here.
Well, it's saving on your eyeballs, I'm sure. You know, I hope that you still do when you do conventions. The last time I saw you at a panel, you were up on stage at Wizard. This is a while ago, and you were painting.
That was a one of a kind situation.
Oh, no kidding. Oh
yeah.
Man!
No, I've never done that before. Since that was very bizarre, and I thought, like, oh, I'll do something that'll just knock people out, and you know, I'm such a big star that everybody will show up for my big painted exposition, and you know, that
was too self-conscious to work
no,
that year.
No.
Okay.
No, too egomaniacal.
I thought it was great.
Because that was positioned on a Sunday,
uh-huh.
You can't get bodies into a convention panel on a Sunday.
I understand.
And I was distressed at the thought, like, wait a minute, I know how many people are here at this show. Where are they? You know, it wasn't nearly enough people attending for the sake of my self-importance. So I kind of thought, yeah, you know what, that's okay. You know, you can do it in print, let people read about it, but, you know, that was well done. It came off well in terms of the, you know, the video presentation where people could see a
yeah.
big projection of everything. It was cool. But you know, I also get myself in trouble if I'm exposed to the public for too long, because my opinions are like the average fan's opinions. They're striking and harsh and filled with all kinds of detail of what things everybody else is doing that's wrong. And I should be shut off from the press world in some ways, which maybe that goes for even this interview, but the thing is, you know, being typical of many of us reading and following comics, you know, the difference with me is that I'll get more people upset at me than anybody else who expresses their opinions
sure.
online or, you you know. And so I might connect with a certain amount of people that might agree with me exactly, but then there's all the rest of these people that are going to get really honked off at whatever opinions I've shared that are contrary to theirs.
Well, I understand. So, but the good news is there's a lot of good work out there, and luckily you're working with the right editors that are letting you do your thing. And case in point, case study, the motion comic. You and Paul Dini did a fine job in print, and we will see it in motion as well on iTunes, and I definitely encourage everyone to check it out. A wonderful story given to us by Paul Dini and Alex Ross, who has been kind enough to give us some time today and on a subsequent Word Balloon, I hope, so we can talk about more, because there's a large body of work that we haven't even touched yet.
Absolutely.
Including your love of Battle for the Planets.
Oh, man. See, right there, that could be another one where I open up a can of things that will come back to haunt me.
Well, I appreciate your time, Alex. Pleasure talking to you, and good luck with this venture, and certainly more with Avengers Invaders, the culmination of Justice Society America, and Project Superpowers.
Thank you very much.
I've been trying to set that interview up for a long time, and guys like Doug Cloud have been trying to get me, but finally, the guys at Warner Brothers were able to get Alex Ross for me. So thanks, guys. I appreciate that. And again, look forward to a future Word Balloon with Alex, where we'll get into many more of his great projects. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Witchblade, the anime series, available now on DVD and digital download. It's based on the comic book series from Top Cow Productions. The anime series goes into the future to tell the tale of a new bearer of the Witchblade and the conspiracy that surrounds her burden. The 24-episode series box set features wraparound box art by Mark Silvestri. The box set also includes 100 minutes of extra features, including all you want to know about Top Cow, with interviews and a tour. Witchblade is also available as a digital download at iTunes, PS3, PlayStation Store, Xbox, and Amazon. To view clips from the series and the box art, go to Funimation.com/Witchblade. That's Witchblade, the anime series, available now on DVD and digital download from Funimation Entertainment. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. You can find us at iTunes, at, of course, Newsarama.com, and our home space, WordBalloon.com, where there's an archive of well over 175 interviews of your favorite comic book artists, writers, filmmakers, television people, you name it, they're there at WordBalloon.com. Any questions or comments about the show, you can reach the Word Balloon Forum, which is there at WordBalloon.com, also at JinxWorld.com, or you can write me an email if you'd like directly, John@WordBalloon.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.